Welcome back. Good to have you with us. That last segment was, just to let you all know, was shot and filmed by the Real News Network, so that'll be appearing on there at some point soon. And our one of our new media partners, we're moving into their building slowly but surely, and they were here in the studio doing that last segment, so let you know that what's going on. But they're not here now, but we are. And I want you to join us at 410-319-8888 as we look at the future of where unions are going. Jeff Singer's remained in the studio with us here. Carrietta Hires has stayed with us here for a little bit from 1199 as an organizer. We're joined by Mike Lewis, who's been a guest on the show before. He's a former Sparrows Point steelworker and was financial secretary for the United Steelworkers here in Baltimore. And I saw him the other night at a event that took place with UMBC as they were doing this whole story about Sparrows Point, the history of Sparrows Point and steelworkers, and he was part of the panel. The room was filled with steelworkers, and they said such moving, important things that I thought important to kind of get their voices on the air in this conversation and continue conversations with them and others about where unions are going in this community and world of ours. And so he is here with us. Sam Williamson is with us. She's a bartender and server at Creative Food Group at the BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport and a leader of Unite Here Local 7. Good to have you in the studio, Sam.
It's nice to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410. Oh, that's one of our favorite people out. He's on our show as well. Bill Fletcher's with us. He's racial justice, labor, and international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 of the Myths About Unions. When he graduated from college, he went to work as a welder in the shipyard and entered the labor movement. He's senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the immediate past president of the Trans-Africa Forum. Bill, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be on the program. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you with us, man. Always a pleasure. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So just an overarching question for you. I mean, this is because you all represent such different segments of the world here. You've been in unions, Bill, involved most of your life. You do a lot of writing about it. I saw the piece you wrote in The Nation when The Nation magazine had this back and forth about what really happened in Wisconsin. We'll raise some of the issues there because they're germane on some levels. And here we have two unions representing low-wage workers who are trying to organize. One's trying to unite here, and 1199 are in the House at the moment talking about their struggles because there was this three-day strike in Baltimore that 1199 led at Johns Hopkins Hospital and medical centers. And we have Mike Lewis with us from the Steelworkers Union that was crushed in Baltimore, really. It sold the plant. This is one of the biggest unions ever in the history of Maryland and one of the most powerful unions in the country that has lost a lot of power. And so let's reflect on what this means and this kind of polar ends of what we're seeing as the destruction of what are middle-class unions, the unions that built the middle class, and people trying to survive and build unions. So, Bill, in that kind of very broad, confusing segment I just said, how do you see that?
Well, it was broad, but it certainly wasn't confusing.
Thank you.
I think that what's evident in struggles such as the ones that you're documenting today is the question of who is an economy supposed to serve. And once upon a time, there was a notion that when productivity increased, that the living standard of workers should increase, and that workers had a right to collective bargaining, they had a right to a voice on the job. And over the last 30 years, that entire concept has been eroded, if not attacked outright. And we now have a situation where we're being told that people at the top have every right to enrich themselves, and people at the bottom, and by the bottom, I mean the bottom 80% of the population, just simply have to take it. And the difficulty is that this notion, as absurd as it is, has gained ground over these last 20 to 30 years. And so you'll hear economists, you'll hear commentators basically raising this over and again, that, well, we can't go too far. We can't push too far. We can't raise the wages, but so far. And it begs several questions. How are people supposed to survive? How are people supposed to buy things? How is the economy supposed to function if the people that do the work, that make the economy actually move, simply can't have a living wage and basic and satisfactory working conditions? So we're looking really at a peculiar clash of civilizations all within one country, here in the United States.
You know, and I want to take what you've just said, Bill, and over the next hour we'll explore that whole concept in depth and where that takes us. I'm curious, though, at this moment, just to, before we get to these phone calls coming in at 410-319-8888, is as a member of a powerful union that fought to keep your jobs, Mike Lewis, and steelworkers, and you're sitting across the table now from 1199, which is battling for the rights of the lowest paid workers at Hopkins Hospital, and also Unite Here, which is battling for the lowest paid workers that are in a semi-public private system. What do you say?
It's really complex, Mark. It's a struggle, and it's almost as though history is repeating itself from the pre-Roosevelt era when people fought for a better wage. That's how the union movement really evolved. And a lot of it was the industrial unions that really fought, stood on the lines, were attacked, you know. And I think a lot of people in this country, unfortunately, even some union members, thought that the battle was over, you know. And you see this repeating itself over and over again. And I'll go back. I heard you mention Wisconsin. I happened to work with Chris McLaren, and I worked.
The steel worker.
We actually did some work for the International Union on the recall out there and did some phone banking. And what's amazing to me is that Scott Walker got 38% of the vote from union households. And that's a phenomenon. I call it the Fox News phenomenon, you know, that people who owe their standard of living got real comfortable in some cases. And they get divided on these issues like guns and abortion, and they vote against their own economic interests. And unfortunately, that happens all too frequently. You see that happening over and over again. And it dawns the question, how did we get so comfortable that we allowed the forces that were always at work, these right-to-work forces, you know, these anti-union forces, to make us think that we no longer needed unions anymore.
Absolutely.
And what we see is now people are beginning to wake up to income inequality. People are beginning to realize that the haves have it. I mean, even as R.G. Steel was battling in bankruptcy court, our members were losing their unused vacation. They were stuck with medical bills. The top 10 executives from R.G. Steel went to the bankruptcy court and asked for $2 million each.
Wow.
You know, and it's
not funny, but
it's not funny.
It's not funny at all, but I'm.
And it's almost an acceptance that they deserve everything they get, and that we, the working class, should be fortunate that we have anything at all.
Carrie, Edda, what were you about to say? I heard you were really responding just physically to what he was saying.
I listened to you. I come from the era, my pop was a steel man.
Okay.
And we grew up with the notion that as long as you had your union card, you had a job, and this job provides you with good wages and benefits. So all I ever wanted to do was be like my pop and have a union job. I started off working at Hopkins Hospital before eventually becoming the rep for Hopkins Hospital. And the most important thing you said was that we've gotten complacent because of those union jobs. We were able to, back in the day, afford a mortgage and a car. So we thought that we had it, and we were no longer hungry. We weren't hungry. Now, when you find someone that's hungry, they'll fight. And that's what's happening now, I believe, with our workers at Hopkins Hospital, because they're hungry, they're tired, they're looking around, and they're being disrespected by telling them, oh, they're just this, they're just that. But I dare them, and I told them at the end of the three-day strike, was that they're all professionals in what they do, because the hospital can't function. Yeah, we're out on the picket line, yet they had to bring in contractual workers, pay everyone time and a half to get in to do the jobs that, oh, everything's fine in here, to do the jobs that our professionals actually do. Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying now, and I think this is so. Did we think that? And Sam, I didn't feature in the studio. You can jump in here as well. You know, Bill, I'm thinking about it. Is part of the demise of unions because unions built the middle class, because people got so comfortable, not trying to lay the blame on unions. I'm just saying, is that an aspect of this?
Well, I wouldn't talk about it, the demise of the unions. I would say
I'll take demise off the table again. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, no. I think it's important. We face the possibility of annihilation. That is true. That there's no doubt about that. We face that as a possibility. Unions face that possibility for external and internal reasons. The external reasons is that the economy reorganized in the late 70s, early 80s, and the dominant philosophy was one that said eliminate any and all obstacles to the accumulation of profit. And if that's a union, you eliminate it, pure and simple. And that is the philosophy, and it's been glamorized, it's been dramatized on television, but that is the philosophy. So that's what we're dealing with externally, and one current manifestation of this is the activities of the notorious Koch brothers, KOCH, the right-wing billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's internal issues. The internal issues go back to the late 1940s, early 50s, where I would argue and have argued that the union stopped acting like a movement and instead acted more like a trade association. And they were focused not on the larger needs of working class people overall, but focused increasingly on what would happen to the people that were lucky enough to be in a union. So instead of the real kind of ethos of a social justice movement, an economic justice movement, increasingly, particularly after they got rid of some of their best leaders in the late 40s as part of the Cold War purges, increasingly they started to turn inward. And in turning inward, they broke faith with a lot of workers out there that, even if they couldn't be in unions, were pulling for unions. And were looking at unions as an instrument for a broader economic justice. So if we're going to survive, if we're not going to become extinct like the Tyrannosaurus, then we have to flip the script completely. And for many leaders in our movement, this is going to be really rough, because they were brought up with a certain view that the union fights for wages, hours, and working conditions in a particular workplace or with a particular workforce. And what's needed right now is a very different kind of movement that, frankly, is going to raise a lot of hell.
This is a very important point. We have a caller here. I'm going to let Sam respond to this caller first at 410-319-8888. And I'm going to raise this whole question of movement versus trade association and look at it in greater depth when we come back here. 410-319-8888. Yama, you're on the air.
Yes, I think it's wrong to say to an employer, you're compelled to increase this wages of this employee based on longevity. If the wages will be increased based on time and skills acquisition, I would agree with that. But you can't just be there for 9 years and not take in any of those new environmental control classes or any of the customer service classes to improve your skills. I was a patient at Johns Hopkins, and I tried to get out because the help there was not nice. And finally, the young man who's complaining that he has to buy a lot of gas to get to his job, I'm making $55,000 a year and catching the bus, carrying my lunch in a paper bag. What happened to that? People don't do that anymore? Do they not economize?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm sure he does economize a lot, but who'd like to respond? Do you want to start, Carrietta? Or...
So, I guess I'm a bit confused about your statement, because what happens to the worker who actually takes advantage of the service excellent classes, who actually goes to school? Do they not deserve to have improved wages as well? Should they still be stuck or punished because they're in these non-technical positions?
Sam, the caller is hung up. I'm sorry, but
and also it's a myth that the people working these $12, $10, $9 hours don't work hard. and don't do the best that they can. You're going to have bad employees everywhere. Just look over in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill. You have some highly paid bad employees. However, everybody deserves to make a living wage. Our economy needs it.
Absolutely.
You know, when you say we need, it seems like as a businessman, I would want customers. And customers need to have money to spend to buy the product that I produce. If I was a banker, I would want people taking out mortgage loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know a banker that would approve a mortgage application when $12 an hour is put on it.
Nobody's going to approve that.
Right. Sam, nobody's going
to
approve
that. We haven't heard your voice. I apologize. So come in here and give your thoughts on what you just heard.
So I would say coming from a family that had no union jobs and never having worked in a job represented by a union before, that most of what I think is an obstacle towards unionizing, especially at the airport where most people haven't had a union job, is the idea that this is what we deserve. This is our expectation. One of my coworkers, he says to me all the time, he's like, I came to work in a restaurant. I know that I'm going to get paid $3.63 an hour. I know that I'm not going to get health insurance for the job. I'm not going to get benefits. I'm not going to have a retirement plan. And if I wanted a job that provided me with those things, then I would have to go somewhere else. And to me, why do we accept that people are working full time and they're not getting benefits? They're not getting wages that they can live off of. But it's this idea of this is what we deserve, this myth that in the U.S., you can work to where you deserve to be. And if you can only get $3.63 an hour, or in the airport where among the concession workers the mean wage is $8.50 an hour, is that what all 800 of us deserve? Is $8.50 an hour when we work hard, when we're doing the best we can?
$8.50 an hour. I mean, I defy most people who listen to this program to think about, I mean, there are people listening to this program who do work and live on $8.50 an hour, but most people who do not, every time I've interviewed the governor, or it was Governor Ehrlich before that, we talked about raising the minimum wage, I asked them if they would take a test. Would you take a test if you spend an entire week living on $8 an hour? See what you could do. Where could you go?
And not only that,
where
Mark,
could you live?
Absolutely.
Not only that, Mark, the jobs that most people take, the $8.50 an hour job, and at some point want to pivot to the job, say at a General Motors plant, if you didn't go to college, or at a plant like down at Spurrell's Point or some other facility that then paid a union wage. But those jobs are disappearing.
Right.
So what you have is the people at the very top who have all of the connections, who get the top-paying jobs, and then you have everybody else struggling. I mean, they're touting here in the city of Baltimore, Amazon coming to replace, to build a warehouse where GM was, mm-hmm. with all of these $12 an hour jobs. So you have a warehouse coming to a place where a factory was, the factory that paid $21 an hour with benefits and retirement, being replaced by a $12 an hour job.
So we have to take a break here. When we come back, I want to talk about how we create that. We're going to be joined here as well by Kim Jensen, who is an associate professor of English. They're trying to organize because they're adjunct workers. So there's all kinds of people trying to organize in this country. And the latest polls are very confusing about what people want from unions. And I really want to explain, we'll start with Bill Fletcher, explore what that means and how this new movement can happen in America when it comes to unions and wages. And some people would say it's economically impossible because we don't have the economic base to allow people to have higher wages. Well, we'll explore that myth or reality. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back as we continue our discussion here, this roundtable on the future of labor. Given what's happening in the Baltimore area kind of led to this discussion, Carrietta Hires from 1199 is going to stay with us for a few more minutes. She's with us here in the studio. Jeff Singer is going to stay with us. Mike Lewis is here, former financial secretary for United Steelworkers. We are here with Bill Fletcher, who is a racial justice labor international activist and author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. He used to be the president of Trans Africa Forum. Sam Williamson is a bartender and server at the Creative Food Group at BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport and a leader in the Unite Here Local 7, struggle to unionize workers at the airport. Kim Jensen has joined us, who is an associate professor of English at the Community College of Baltimore County. She's a poet and author who has been part of the movement to force the state legislature to allow professors at junior colleges who are adjunct professors to unionize. They're all here with us, 410-319-8888. And Bill, let me come back to you and talk about this idea of movement versus trade association. And you talked about that this is kind of almost internal struggle within the union movement about what they should be, what they can become. And around this table we have, as I said, all these various different union movements, from college professors to restaurant workers to hospital workers to steel workers. So what does that mean to have this movement? How does that change things? How do we get there?
I'll give you an example. So first of all, this has been a conflict within the union movement since it very began. It's initial stages. It's really something that's hardwired in to the movement. Is it a movement or is it a lobby, essentially? And to give you an example, a positive example, look at the Chicago teacher strike from a few years ago. Now, you had the situation where, in going into the strike, the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, aimed to paint the teachers as if they were a special interest, a lobby, self-concerned, selfish, actually. And a reform group took over the local, the teachers' union there, and began a process of both educating its own membership about the issues at stake, but also reaching out to the community to unite the issues that they were fighting around, with the concerns that the community had around quality education. When the strike ultimately happened, it ended up becoming a strike for the kids. The parents stood with the teachers. The parents did not go for the okie-do. They stood with the teachers and supported the teachers through the length of the strike. Unions can do this. This is what I mean about, you know, the question of building a movement and being understood to be representatives of a larger population. All too often when we're engaging in our battles, it's quite understandable that we find ourselves in a situation up against a monster. We're fighting it out. We don't stop and think about who else out there is or should be concerned about the issues that we're raising. We get so focused on that particular employer that we forget that we absolutely need allies and that we need to convince the broader public that we're actually fighting on their behalf. When we are able to do that, time and again, we win. When we don't do that, as happened in 1981 with the PATCO strike, as happened in 1987 with the football strike, when we only focus internally, we lose. In fact, we get our clocks clean.
This is an important point. I'd like to right now very quickly bring Kim Jensen in the conversation and Sam Williamson, let have you jump in as well. And when you hear what Bill Fletcher was saying, talk to me how that works for the two of you, how you expand on that idea. And I also want to hear, before you have to carry out your thoughts. Mm-hmm. Kim?
Okay, so first of all, thank you for having me.
Good
it's really exciting to be here with this distinguished panel. And I did want to add on to what Bill Fletcher said, which was so well put. And that is, so I teach full-time at the Community College of Baltimore County, and I have a very stable job with benefits. But I've been working on the building a union campaign for the Community College employees, and that includes adjuncts. And I'm very much in solidarity with the adjuncts, who I liken to basically being the migrant workers of education. They are underpaid. They have no benefits. They have no job security. They could be offered a class and have it canceled the day before school starts.
With no compensation.
So adjuncts really are at the forefront of the necessity for a union. And so when we think of these workers, the way that we can reach out, as Bill's saying, and talk about this as a labor movement, as a social movement, as a grassroots movement, is that we need to speak to the necessity in America of quality, sustainable education. So I was thinking this morning about what that means to have sustainable education in America. How can you have real education in America when 80% of the class is being taught in the community colleges in Maryland are taught by people who are adjuncts, who themselves are vulnerable workers. So we do need, we can, it's an exciting moment in Maryland. It's a really exciting moment. I'm really positive about the possibility of us organizing across the state and across the country for this community college unionization movement. And we reach out to the community and we say, what we do, we want our working conditions as teachers are the students' learning conditions. And the union, we work in partnership to say we can improve what goes on in the classroom, we can improve what goes on our campuses by having everyone treated equitably.
Sam, how do you see that in terms of the work you're doing?
I think that everyone that I work with, we understand that if we had better jobs, it would definitely help our communities. And you see that when we have some managers who are very capricious will take away days if they don't like you. And if you don't get enough hours and you're at low wages anyway, to fill that gap, some people will start selling drugs or doing other illegal activities. Now, if you
just to make ends meet.
Just to make ends meet. Because there are no good jobs. And if you created good jobs, that it certainly wouldn't fix the whole prison industrial complex, but you would help make an impact on the communities. And so our part of that is to focus on tangibly what can we do and what is the next step for us. And I see the next step as creating better jobs. And I would love to work hand in hand with groups that are dismantling the rest of that industry, the prison industry.
So, Carrie, before you have to roll, I know you got to go in a minute, so why don't you throw it? I mean, because two things. I mean, you know there are people who would say that the hospital workers, they're unskilled workers, they don't deserve these higher wages. There's a lot of that kind of scuttlebutt around, and you're kind of at the other end of the PR spectrum, right, in this thing in many ways. So how do you respond to that about building a movement?
I can actually echo what Sam said. The community around Hopkins has been fondly, in some circles and unfondly in some other circles, called Hopkinsville. Hopkins has bought up homes from Broadway and North Avenue to as far back down to Wolf, all the way down to the southern parts of Wolf Street. So they sort of kind of control and own all of that. Some of these areas were some of the poorest places a long, 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 long time ago, and that was Butcher's Hill, is that, you know, going around. So if Hopkins would come back to the table to pay the workers this livable wage, workers who actually live in that area, whose children go to school in that area, it would actually lift the consciousness of the community. People would feel better about it. And going through with this this struggle, we've had the opportunity to educate the community and empower them on what's actually going behind. It's just not unskilled workers demanding $15 an hour, but it's about lifting them out away from poverty-level wages. Poverty-level wages, because a long time ago, if you were able to get the job at Johns Hopkins Hospital, people automatically assumed that it was a high-paying job because it was at the great Johns Hopkins Hospital. And through this process, the public now knows that it's not high-paying jobs at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and that Johns Hopkins Hospital considers the support staff as being unskilled.
Right.
And not worthy of a livable wage. So it goes back again to educating and empowering the community on just what's going on at Johns Hopkins Hospital. A news reporter just took a little tidbit after asking all the questions, and I called the poverty level wages at Johns Hopkins Hospital the dirty little secret. Well, now the dirty little secret is out, and it's time to step up to the plate and not only lead the way medically, but also lead the way in giving support staff a livable wage.
Let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. I know, Carrie, you might have to roll, but it's great to have you in the studio. Look forward to continuing this conversation with you as we see what happens between 1199 and Johns Hopkins Hospital Medical Services.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here.
Bye-bye.
410-319-8888 is the number here, and Shell, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to respond to the young lady that basically talked about her $55,000 a year job and that she bags her lunch and takes the bus. I think that it was an assumption that those that are working at Johns Hopkins that are making that minimum wage, minimum wages, are not doing the same. I was a former orderly. I know what it takes to be an orderly. It is a thankless job. And I kind of almost want to take I do take offense to them calling or categorizing these workers as unskilled workers. They are a support staff with a lot of skill, and they are more than deserving of a 15-year service to a dedicated service to get $1 a year. That's outrageous to even buck at the thought of having that done.
Shell, thank you so much for that call. I appreciate your thoughts and also putting out there what you did for a living as well before to get a sense of that history and what people go through to get to places. You know, I think that there's got to be, and we're going to have some public housing workers come on in the last part of the show somewhere. I guess we'll be staying for that as well. And Jeff Singer has somebody he's going to bring up at that point that he wants to bring up when they get here. But this solidarity among unions and reaching out to the community seems to be a very critical factor. We saw things turn upside down in Wisconsin with 38% of the union households voted against themselves in many ways by supporting the governor's position. You've written about that, Bill Fletcher, and there's been a lot of back and forth about all that. So this is a tough nut to crack. I mean, how you begin to even make that happen, because there are many unions, especially the ones and many of the union leaders nationally, are reluctant to do that. Because they are their trade association shops. That is what they do. And going beyond that ground doesn't is not in their purview. I mean, it's just not in their frame of reference on how they think. So what does that mean? What kind of struggle has to happen to even make that become part of a conversation? Bill, you want to start us off and we'll go around the room?
Sure. So one of the things we have to understand about what took place in Wisconsin is that when many of the private sector manufacturing unions were under assault in the 1980s, if we want to be honest, we'll admit that many public sector and service unions took a pass. Rather than coming forward and providing the kind of support that was needed, they unfortunately believed that they were going to be impervious. It was not going to happen to them. Resentment built up among many workers who then started looking at public sector and service workers as if they were a privileged group. And this played into the hands of forces like the notorious Koch brothers. You know, when people looked at us as not supporting them, they felt like, well, if that's the case, then why should I support you later on? Now, what this means is that we have to change the way we look at trade unionism. And again, this is going to be difficult. It really means that our leaders need to think differently. It means that we need to talk with our members about what's going on. It has been done. It can be done. This is not an impossible task, but it necessitates a recognition. Frankly, I don't think we have much in the way of an alternative. I mean, the clock is ticking.
Right.
And each time we just simply carry on these battles by ourselves, and are fighting only for those people who are lucky enough to be union members, the clock gets closer to midnight.
And also to that, Mark, we have to recognize that the anti-union forces out there, being funded by groups like the Koch brothers, are really pushing their agenda. I look at the Steelworkers Union for an example. A lot of people say it's the United Steelworkers, and you only think about representing people at steel plants. We go beyond that. We represent the paper workers, the refinery workers. We represent some hospital workers. And the push to organize the college athletics is by the United Steelworkers. So unions do have to diversify themselves. I like to think that, and I'm proud of my union, we've done a job at trying. But at the same time, part of what we have to do is try to maintain and not lose another Sparrow's Point. And that becomes the challenge. We have to organize, we have to diversify, but we still have to fight that day-to-day seems like never-ending struggle of trying to maintain what we already have and not lose anymore, because these right-to-work forces, as we saw in Tennessee, with a lot of political power, you know, at the Volkswagen plant, are hard at work, leaving no stone unturned. And while they may not have money they claim to pay the average worker, somehow or another, they find the money to fund anti-union campaigns. Mm-hmm. And they always seem to find the money for executive compensation packages, which I don't think any of them have taken a hit at all over the last 30 years. And in fact, one would suggest that executive compensation is on steroids, while everyday wages is on life support.
Yeah. One could make that argument, as Jeff Singer did earlier in this program, talking about the wages of Hopkins presidents and vice presidents and the wages of the workers who are not college graduates there, because they Kim.
So I wanted to bring it back to the community college context again, and I wanted to kind of tag onto what Carrie had said earlier, which struck a chord with me, when she said that, well, people used to assume that, oh, you're working for Hopkins, you must be making a good wage. Well, it's interesting because our adjunct professors are teaching students who themselves are trying to create a future for themselves economically. And to this year at the Community College of Baltimore County, we have a program called the Community Book Connection. And this year's text was a book called The Working Poor by David Shibler. And it's a book about what it means to work at a low-wage job in America, to work hard in America and not get by, which is what we're talking about here today. And so all year long, we've been studying the working poor, and teachers who are teaching the working poor, in fact, many of them are the working poor. And it's really hard to explain to students.
Right.
It's hard to explain to students that to be a role model to your students on this is how you make it, this is how you you know, kind of dig yourself out of poverty. And a lot of our students are the working poor when their role models themselves are the working poor. And so so the clock, to echo what Bill's saying, the clock is ticking. I think every time we all turn on the news in the morning and we hear about executive compensation and the two-tier compensation structures, the time is now. We do need to band together, all of us at this table and beyond, and rebuild this union movement. One of the reasons I'm involved is not just because, you know, I'm an educator or because it's an economic thing. For me, it's a political necessity in America today that the workers need to have a pushback against the top dogs who are really calling the shots. McCutcheon decision, you know, all of these new decisions that are coming out are letting us know that we're not doing our jobs good enough and we need to do better.
And speaking of that, I mean, there's going to be a decision coming down in June in the Supreme Court, that is Harris versus Quinn. And if the Supreme Court rules against the union in Harris versus Quinn, it'll mean that unions have what they call an agency fee, that if a union represents all the workers in a shop, but all the workers are not part of the union, so the union members pay their union dues, but to a lesser extent, non-union workers who they represent pay an agency fee, which is less than a union dues, but that will be taken out of union coffers if this passes, if the Supreme Court rules on this. And my guess, given the Supreme Court, that's how they're going to rule, which will cut back even further on the ability. In other words, if the teachers in Chicago have this union and 70% of the teachers are in that union, they pay the union dues, 30% don't, but they pay an agency fee, which is less, that money will be gone because they'll no longer have to do that. So these little kind of pieces keep getting stuck to kind of whittle unions down. And I wonder, let me go to the phones here. Then I do have two very specific questions, which are really tough questions, I think, about unions, which is where unions are in terms of the establishment and the salaries union officials make and being tied to the Democratic Party, and the divide between unions and environmentalists and how that might be hurting the union movement. I think that deserves an explanation as well. 410-319-8888. Michael Scott, you're on the air.
Yes, great conversation. You know, I think organizing is right. I think where organizing breaks down is, you know, we've got to really look at it in the context of a larger power analysis, because all of these things are not unrelated. And when you ask the question, you know, what could happen with the prison industrial complex, you're assuming that it's not happening the way some people are benefiting from it, right? And so, you know, if we do a power analysis with organizing as the backstop, then we come to some very different conclusions. And more importantly, we start to have common interests beyond our narrow, thinly sliced sort of clustered interests. And I think that is what you saw in Wisconsin, and I think that is what is required. And that involves having some really tough conversations. You know, we're a southern state in Maryland, but we don't like to talk about certain things. But at the end of the day, every movement has broken down along race, including the great work of Saul Alinsky. So, you know, until we are able to do a full power analysis and kind of put these things into context with an organizing and a very strategic approach that gets to the root causes of some of this stuff, then I think we'll continue in Maryland to fight, you know, sort of balkanized battles.
Very interesting. Somebody respond to what Michael was saying. Bill, you want to tackle it first, and then we'll go around the room real fast?
Well, I mean, I think that the caller is right. I mean, that race has been the tripwire, not just for the union movement, but for virtually every progressive social movement in the United States, and that you can't run around it. You have to deal with it directly. So I think that is part of what our challenge, but it's only part of the challenge, because the movement has to understand itself to be a movement for what the Occupy force is called the 99%. It's got to be a movement for the majority and position itself that way.
We had a note here from Claudia, who wrote in, since we're talking about unions, we were going to do something about this anyway, but I'll announce it on the air, that the Charm City Labor Chorus is having their fifth anniversary concert. And they're concerted with Leah Gilmore singing with them, special guest star Leah Gilmore, Saturday, April 26th at 7 p.m. here at Morgan State University at the Recital Hall, the Carl J. Murphy Fine Arts Center. And you can get information at Charm City Labor Chorus @gmail.com. We'll put that on our website. But they'll be with Leah Gilmore. They'll be singing labor and freedom songs here at Morgan State University to celebrate on April the 26th. So thank you for writing that in, Claudia. Appreciate that and getting that out there. It's a perfect moment to talk about that. 410-319-8888. We have to take a break here. It's time for a break? I guess it is, yes. Mike Lewis, you have to roll. Is that what I understand?
No.
He says no, he's not going to roll. Good. With Steele's not rolling, everybody's staying. 410-319-8888. We'll see who we can fit in this room coming in the next hour. Stay with us, and we will continue our conversation. We're going to explore public unions. We're also going to explore these questions I raised at the end of the hour about who unions are aligned with in terms of Democratic Party and not Democratic Party. What does that have to do with the future of unions and the whole question of the environmental movement? Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us as we have this special day talking to union workers from many different unions and places across our community. And reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. It's right there. We are here with continuing with our conversation. A couple workers left. A couple more workers walked in. So we will continue. Kim Jensen had to go. She left, and we are continuing. Mike Lewis from the Steelworkers is still with us. Sam Williamson from Local 7, working to organize workers at the airport, is here with us. Jeff Singer's in the studio. He won't be silent for much longer. Bill Fletcher remains by phone, the racial justice, labor, international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, is with us as well. We are now joined here in studio by Anthony Coates, who is local president of Ask Me Local 647, Baltimore City Housing Authority. And Lucky Crosby's with us. Lucky is maintenance mechanic who's worked for the Baltimore City Housing Authority for a decade and an active union member. And you all are 410-319-8888. Right to the phones. Wanda in Baltimore County, you're on the air. Hi, Wanda, welcome. Well, hold on. If you come back and see if you're there, we'll come back to you in just a minute. So let me, before we bring the public workers into this, I just want to kind of raise the other issue I raised a moment ago. This is a huge issue, I think, for people. And of course, Tony and Anthony and Lucky and Bus can jump in this and answer this as well. But some people would argue, and have been argued in that battle you had, written battle back and forth in Nation magazine, Bill Fletcher, that part of the problem is that unions are much too cozy with just the Democratic Party. It doesn't mean that so Wanda's there? Okay, wait a second. Bill Fletcher's not there. Okay. So let me just raise it to you all that the unions have been much too cozy with the Democratic Party, and only Democratic Party, not saying they should be cozy with Republicans, just saying just Democratic Party, that there's power in unions that are there that they're not using, and that spending all this money, $100 million in Democratic campaign, as opposed to spending it in other ways, that if you took, some people argued in one of these articles that was in the Nation magazine that if every union official capped their salary at $100,000 a year, because you have union officials making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year. And they mentioned the UE, United Electrical Workers, where the president can never make more than the highest paid worker in that union. They had that money, there'd be $300 million left over for those unions to use to hire organizers instead. So talk a bit about that. Are unions too allied just with pushing the Democratic Party agenda? I'm not saying you shouldn't vote for Democrats, vote whatever you want to. I don't care.
I don't think so, Mark, because what you have to do is, like any organization, you interview a candidate, you read what their platform is, and it's kind of hard to endorse a candidate who is right to work, who does not support the concept of organized labor, and their platform in and of itself, for the most part, on the Republican Party, in order to get through a Republican primary, is that you have to be anti-union. You have to be anti-worker. And it kind of makes it hard for any labor organization to say, hey, I want to vote for you. I want to throw out resources towards your candidacy.
So, but I'd like to hear some other thoughts on that. Sam, I mean, I saw your eyes kind of open when I said that. What are your thoughts on this before we go?
Well, I would say in the campaign that we have at BWI Airport, we have been really pressuring O'Malley to this is a state-owned building. We've been putting a lot of pressure on O'Malley to take more action, to the point where when he sees us, you can see in his face, he just looks so unhappy when he sees the red Unite Here t-shirt, just like, oh, no, they're here again. We don't want to talk to them. So I would say that we're not, at least in my experience on my campaign, we are not that close to the Democratic Party. My eyes were surprised to hear how much some of the union staff are making. I guess that's what you're referring to. The staff that I know work so hard, and they're certainly not making that kind of money, but it is surprising to hear that somebody at the top of a union would be taking in that kind of money from dues.
We're talking about people at the top of national and international unions are making that kind of money, and the question is whether they should be. I mean, is that something that hurts movements as well? And I think that's something that, you know, internally unions have to look at, about which way they're going. And the core question over, you know, the fighting for jobs is important, but, you know, you were talking about petroleum workers earlier, and, you know, petroleum workers and pipeline workers who are organizing to kind of build this pipeline, but then environmentalists and communities are fighting against building this pipeline because it's destroying the environment, and they think we should start building solar and wind and some of the things that make it better for the future of our children, not just everything being on gas and oil. So, I mean, those kind of things are like Cove Point here in Maryland, where they want to build this new liquid natural gas facility, natural gas facility, and many unions are for it, but many community people are against it. And Naomi Klein just wrote a really interesting article the other day about how part of the reason that the gas industry is so keen on pushing Russia back in Ukraine is because we've become the Saudi Arabia of gas. We want to push our gas out to Europe, part of the reason. So, I mean, this is a complex, but these are complex things I think a union has to wrestle with if they're going to grow in power.
And we have a plant the steelworkers represent up in Western Maryland, in Luke, Maryland. It's a paper plant. It was struggling somewhat financially. And we produced this product called black liquor. It's a biofuel. Right now it's a tier one. Every year there's legislation to turn it into a tier one, which means that plant that employs roughly 1,000 workers, it is an economic engine to that community up there in Western Maryland.
Right.
If they lose that tax credit, then they would effectively shut down that plant, that jobs, and that economic engine in that community. Even though the black liquor is reintroduced to the electrical grid and is carbon neutral, the environmental lobby is insistent that we go to wind and solar and we don't transition and that we leave collateral damage in our wake as far as our workforce.
We won't do this today, but we can come back and have this conversation with others because the environmentalists will come back and say, well, the fact is that the way they make black liquor is not carbon neutral. It pollutes the environment even worse than coal when you're making the black liquor itself. And so, which I think is also a fact. The question is, this is where I think this is the difficulty that unions and the larger community have to come together and figure out what the strategy is for the future of America. That's so. We'll come back and we will have that entire debate on the air. Okay.
Okay.
We'll do that. You're going to say something, and we're going to open the phones and come back to Jeff's idea.
If I could just reframe your question a little bit. What had the Democratic Party done for Local 647? Now, mind you, the 200 employees that will be losing their employment, I can guarantee you they're all the Democratic voters. And we have contacted the mayor early that February. She recently responded back to us and told us she have no authority over the Housing Authority of Baltimore City. Well, she could point, well, she import the commissioner, excuse me, of Baltimore City. And now, to ask your question, we need to ask, what had the Democratic leadership in the city of Baltimore done for us? 200 of us will be kicked out in the street. When you talk about low wages, when you look at our wages, we are 100% federally funded. We're not compensated to a federal level. And then for you have a commissioner who received 2 six-figure salaries from the city side and the housing side, but yet still he won't lose a dime. When he got his upper management, none of them are Baltimore City resident, none of them are state of Maryland resident. They were brought in with an agenda to crush this union, which they have not, but we're here to tell you that the union are alive and well, and we shall fight on.
Folks, 410-319-8888 before we turn to Jeff Singer and get Paul into this conversation. It's good to have you on the air. And we're going to Paul's voice last time was an explosively important voice in this program the last time he was here. And Wanda in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Yes, the reason I'm calling in, because this is a great concern for educators who are teaching children daily and can barely make ends meet. We have been without a raise for almost 3 years, and it's just so difficult to be able to buy things that you need, necessities, doctor's appointments, and things of that sort. When you work, I guess, about 17 years as a paraeducator, and you're only making close to $35,000. It's very difficult. It's very expensive to live in Maryland. An apartment, a one-bedroom apartment, costs so much money. And, you know, we pay our athletes so much money, and yet kids who we teach every day and we help them in so many ways, we're not only an educator, we're a social worker. We help kids with their problems. We have extra demands put on us with the new technology coming in, and there's not enough time in the day to do the work. So our legislators really need to look at, you know, the educators and give the pay where it's due. It's long overdue that we get paid a working wage. We are the working poor.
Well, no, I appreciate the call, and I think that your story is very important, and the stories like yours are very important. Maybe you can write us an email or leave us your phone number. We can talk some more about that just to hear your voice and maybe get it down on tape, because I think that we need to hear this. What you're saying is, I think that is true. I mean, that's part of what Jeff Singer said on the show over and over again over the years, which is, especially around the cost of housing and wages. And when we're looking at a woman who's worked all these years in the school system, only makes $35,000 a year, and you have Hopkins workers trying to get to the point where they can make $30,000 a year, you know, working at Hopkins for $50 an hour, this is where we are.
Clearly, all of these problems would be resolved if we had an economy based on producing for human need rather than an economy based on producing for profit. To get there, of course, is our greatest challenge, and I'd aver that if we practiced the politics of solidarity rather than the politics of greed, we could get there. And I want to expand on the singular point about the struggle over public housing and its privatization and what that's doing to the union. As Bill Fletcher mentioned, beginning in 1980, approximately, this all-out assault against unions occurred. The firing of the professional air traffic controllers was the warning shot. And it is true that the public unions, and I was a member of AFSCME at the time, a very proud member of Local 112, the public unions did not do enough to support the private unions. And that has divided and conquered us. But today, now that the private unions are in dreadful condition because of these forces brought against them, and less than 8% of the population now who works in private industry are members of unions. Mm-hmm. But it's the public sector that was growing, the public sector for unions. But now that's under assault.
Yeah.
It's not accidental. And the way that is happening in Baltimore, Maryland, is that with the connivance of the federal government, the city and the housing authority are privatizing our public housing. And part of the way people will make profits when they buy our public housing is by firing 200 union employees who make decent wages, have decent benefits, and decent job protections. They're firing them so that they can be rehired perhaps at half, a quarter of the wage. No one really knows. They won't have any protections. They won't have benefits. The city's supporting this. And although it is true that the Housing Authority is not a city agency, it's not a federal agency either, and the city has the ability to work with the Housing Authority to make good things happen.
Yes.
And they need to step up and do that. But more importantly, we need the unions, the United Steelworkers, Unite Here, 1199E, to come out and support the AFSCME workers, their brothers and sisters, in solidarity. And that's the only way we'll be able to defeat these kinds of divide and conquer politics.
And conversely, your union, Anthony Coates, this should be out on the picket line with the workers at
Absolutely.
Hopkins, right?
And that's why we're here. We're here for solidarity. And because we're the majority of workers, we believe that we can make the change. We can't leave it up to the people who are the choice few, who has an education and hide behind the politics and do nothing for us. We need to galvanize people that are homegrown from our unions or the working class and what have you, so we can put those people in office, people who are sensitive to working class people's needs. That's what we need to do.
We want to invite the listeners to show their solidarity by coming down to Red Emma's on Monday, the 21st of April at 6 p.m. There will be a public housing speak out, and Anthony and Paul and Lucky and residents of public housing will be there to talk about this direct assault against the standard of living of ordinary Baltimoreans.
And I'm moderating.
And Mark Steiner has agreed to moderate, and we're all looking forward to hearing Mark and the workers and the public housing residents about how we can fight for a better Baltimore.
And to say there'll also be a dinner at 6 o'clock, a pay-what-you-can dinner, because people are coming from all levels of income. So pay what you can for the dinner, mm-hmm. as little as you can or as much as you can for the dinners being made for everybody coming to participate in this. 6 o'clock dinner, 7 o'clock forum at Red Emma's this April 21st. 6 p.m. and we'll be talking more about that. It'll be on our radar as well. So I mean, we'll be announcing that more as well. So I'm curious. You know, here we have this. You look at the graphs and charts, and you see where labor unions have taken a nosedive in the last 40 years in America, a high in the late 60s, and it's just plummeting. A high of about 35% of all workers, maybe a bit more, that were once union, and now we're down to maybe 8% of all workers. So,
no, I was going to say there's a similar graph that shows with the decline of union membership, so has the wage decline. It coincides. The unions were the engine that lifted the middle class and built the middle class and brought wages up. And the decline of union membership, which was a concerted, coordinated effort, also parallels the decline in wages. So everything that we're now fighting to regain, we had, but when we lost that organization that was the instrument that brought it up, when that declined, wages declined with it. Now, I don't know anybody that can say that they benefited from being non-union. If you look in the South and right-to-work states, the poverty level is the highest, and the wages and base pays and salaries are the lowest. where you have high union membership, you have a higher standard of living and higher wages. And some people complain about paying dues. Well, I'll tell you, I got a lot for my dues. And I couldn't get a return on any investment any better than I ever paid in my life.
So where do we think, I'm curious where you all think we go from here. And I just, you know, as we conclude these last 10 minutes or so together, and folks can join us at 410-319-8888. There was a power in unions, but like in your steelworkers union, the retirees lost almost everything they ever had. The benefits gone. Benefits being part of the thing that people are saying is going to bankrupt city and state governments that are going to be what you're hoping to retire on, Paul. You know what I'm saying?
But how?
Let me get you in the mic there.
How can they say that that will bankrupt them when you got people in high positions, even in the housing authority, that benefit from our labor? They get bonus checks, $5,000-$10,000. I mean, the average worker just wanted a decent ways to be able to take care of their family, their American dream. There's no longer the American dream anymore. Bethlehem Steel is gone. That's our biggest dream in all of America. We've made the best steel in the world. And our workers are the best workers in the world. They can come and bring in whoever they want from all these other countries. We have already established that we can put it up and it will last a lifetime. We just celebrated Dr. King and his 1968 march down there with 1,300 sanitation workers. And here we are right here fighting the same fight. Elijah Cummings, Mr. Brown, Mr. O'Malley, all the rest of you, Madam Mayor, all the rest of y'all, this fight has already been fought and won. Why now did we come back here and have to fight the same fight to give these kids and to give people an opportunity to take care of themselves? It's ridiculous that you can take and come in here and try to turn Baltimore and Maryland into an Enron and then make the people make America a third world country. We're not competing with them. Everybody in the world want to be like us. So why don't we start being like us and start taking care of Americans first? And everybody else can come in. We had no problem with you coming in, but you got to get your green card or whatever it is you need to get to be a citizen in here and take a part of the solidarity that we got. It's a shame that there's people running around here that got education off the labors of their grandmothers and grandfathers that were slaves and things of that nature, and then to come and get a position and turn that back on people.
Well, let me go here to Sam. Sam, we haven't heard from you in a bit, and I think we come back. That's another debate I think that we need to have, because I think that there's a question whether or not you can put the woes of American workers on the backs of people who came to this country, quote unquote, illegally to look for work. That's not what made our workers lose our jobs. I mean, they're not taking those jobs. The jobs they're taking are so far down the line. So that's another debate. We say the environment and that. These are debates unions have to have with the larger community, I think, about what the reality is. Let me go to Sam to come over here.
It's the salaries.
Sam, you want to jump in on this a little bit?
Sure.
And then come right back to Anthony.
Where do we go next?
Yeah,
I think the only thing that we can do is organize more. There are a lot of people out there who don't have hope that anything could get better. Whether or not it's something that we had before, like at the restaurant I work in, the last company was a union company, and people were making, even the tipped employees were making above what the non-tipped minimum wage is if they'd been there long enough, and they're making real money. They had good health care. They had benefits. And then my company came in, Creative Food Group. They fired everyone who used to work there. They brought on only, I think it was 8 of like the 80 workers, and they took away everything. Everyone's 363 in the front of the house. Unless you have some other sort of arrangement, but the vast majority, 363.
An hour, is that what you're
saying? An hour. And then you have your tips that are supposed to compensate for that. And then you don't have any benefits. So you see it, like even in spaces where there was the better job, it was taken away, and people don't have the hope that we can get it back. And that's what we need, I think we really need to fight, is to have people, no one's going to do it if we don't do it. So we need to stop waiting. We deserve better, and I think that's the fight we need to take to everyone. Not just to people who are already involved in unions or already involved in organizing somewhere else, but to go to people who are living in this system and not, right now, resisting in ways that are not organized.
Anthony, you were going to say what?
I was going to say it's the salaries. We can't blame the salaries that union officials get when the people who make the decisions are getting astronomical salaries. Mm-hmm. The Housing Authority management gets salaries for people that they really don't need. I did an interview with the Sun Paper, and we talked about how secretaries have secretaries, how we have so much waste. And we had more people at one time. We had 600 people in union, in the workforce, and 300 people in management. Now we have less buildings, and we have more than 1,400 people in management and just barely 300 people in the workforce. And this interview was done on the Sun Paper, and after this interview was done, it increased. It's still increasing.
Can I share something with you, Mark?
Please,
I want to tell
Mike
a little
Lewis,
bit about myself.
Steelworkers.
I'm a 1978 graduate, Patterson High School, here in Baltimore. When I got out of school, I applied for 5 jobs. Beth Steel, Armco Steel, General Motors, O'Brien Paint, and took the post office test. Over the course of 4 months, every single one of those places called me for employment. Here's the irony about that as you fast forward. I took the job at Beth Steel. Armco Steel is gone, victim of free trade policies. General Motors Braun Highway is gone. O'Brien Paint building is even demolished on Edison Highway. And they're trying to get rid of the post office. Beth Steel is gone.
They are trying to get rid of the post office.
Yeah.
There was an opportunity for urban Baltimoreans to come out and find hard work and decent work with decent wages in blue-collar Baltimore. Now what you see in Baltimore, you see urban decay. It's not because people are lazy. It's because opportunities have been outsourced. And what has come in to replace any of the places that I just mentioned? Nothing but low-paying jobs.
Part of that problem is the President of the United States had made a statement that we are working for the richest state in the union, and the salaries do not reflect it.
Let me open the phone to you again real fast. 410-319-8888. Edwards in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, how are you this morning?
Very well. Welcome.
Look, I'm so proud of the conversation. I'm from the Virgin Islands. I moved from up north down here 10 years. I'm a member of the Carpenters Union. And things are so bad here in Baltimore that I had to transfer my book back up north. And what bothers me, you hear they says Maryland is the best state in the union with the most rich people and pay the best wages. But all this is nothing but a lie.
I didn't say that.
When I came here from the Caribbean, my brother, my uncle, my aunt, and my sister, they all had to put a bank statement to prove that I'm not coming here to be a bum. Now, all these folks from across the border, and I'm saying it twice, all these folks from across the border from Mexico, they come over here, they are messing up the work system, and not only blacks is hurting in Baltimore, but I talked to white guys also, and many, many of them is hurting because they took out a loan in their house to get a dump truck, a backhoe, and then they can't pay for it. And they said the problem is these Mexicans, and right, they are hurting a lot of black folks in the city because...
All right, Edwards, we're almost out of time. We have like 90 seconds left, so literally 90 seconds, because, I don't think it helps us to kind of divide even further by blaming it on Mexicans or...
Exactly.
But anyway...
Let's look at it. Baltimore City Housing Authority. There's 25,000 vacant houses in Baltimore City. So you think the Housing Authority will have leadership that will create opportunity to renovate these houses and move people in who are paying too much rent, first of all, but the Housing Authority doesn't care because it's about big business. If you follow the money, the mayor's in the pocket for all the big developers.
So we are just about out of time. This has been a really incredibly powerful discussion having you all in here. Anthony, you had 10-second thought, literally, because we have to go.
I can say this. I believe there's nothing that can't be fixed. We just need people to have the courage to sit down to the table with us and do like they said they were going to do instead of making blanket statements.
Amen. Anthony Coates, Paul Williams, and Lucky Crosby from the from Ashby Local 647. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
As always, Jeff Singer, thank you for being in the studio.
Thank you.
Paul Williams, not Paul, we just said Paul Williams. Mike Lewis, I want to thank you for being in. Sam Williams, we're going to have you here in the studio as well. We're going to remind you that also next week, We'll do that. We'll do that tomorrow because we're just plumb out of time. That song says it is time to go. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. You can, and our intern is Alex Boston, our engineer is Andre Melton. You can hear this show again on podcast, any of our past shows on steinershow.org. You can also do it all on iTunes as well. So for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, what you're hearing is Utah Phillips, Dump the Bosses. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Thunder, loaded like a long-eared jack. Boo, why don't you buck like thunder and dump the bosses off your back? All the agonies you suffer, you could end with one good whack.